Why has Russia stayed where it is east of the Dnieper River for the last 3 years? For the reason that President Putin does not want to give NATO an excuse to attack Russia. In other words, the United States leading NATO. That's why they're there. I mean, they could have crossed this river a long time ago. And then the stupid remark that you get from the likes of Kellogg is, well, why haven't they done that yet? Because they're not stupid like you, General. They're trying to avoid a general war. I can't think of any leader in the last 50 years that has worked as tirelessly and as hard as President Putin has to avoid a war in Europe. I mean, he really, really has. We're the ones that pushed the envelope in the 90s in the Balkans. Then we tried to drag all the NATO members into our wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and Libya. He hasn't done these things. We have. Russia is not interested in a general war. I don't know where we go from here. My great concern is not so much the people running Germany. It's who's running the show here in Washington. That's what worries me. Because whatever we do, they will follow. And that's why it's in President Trump's interest and the interest of humanity for him to step forward and say enough's enough. Instead, he likes to play the role of the great father who is sorting the children out that just don't understand and threatening this man Putin who just doesn't understand he must end this war. You know, as though no one else has a role in ending anything. It's depressing. And so you get people like Zelensky, who are well-funded by all the wrong people and represent, a disastrous future for Ukraine and Europe.
And, you know, you say that Putin has done everything he can to try and prevent war, but he also is, as you mentioned a second ago, coming under a lot of pressure, even on his inner circle, as well as some of his population. And I think that he kind of implied or gave a shout out, I guess, to that pressure that he is aware of it and that there are some limits to where he can go and how much restraint he can show. He was asked at a recent interview, I think it was a couple of days ago, the interviewer said, there is a report out that the United States or some other country may conduct a nuclear weapons test. And what would you do if that happened? Here's what he said.
I said that in some countries, preparations are being made for testing, but this is also well known to specialists because there is always a temptation to check the effectiveness of that combat fuel, which has been stored in missiles for many, many years. All this is simulated on computers. Specialists believe that this is sufficient, but some of these specialists think that it would be necessary to conduct real-life tests. And in some countries, as far as we know, they are considering this and even preparing for it. So I said that if they conduct tests, we will do the same. Is this good or bad? From the point of view of ensuring security, it is good. From the point of view of the overall picture related to deterrence, to actions aimed, if not at reducing, then at restraining the arms race, it is probably not bad.
So he's focused there on deterrence, but he seems to be saying, hey, if you test, we'll test. But if the weapons are needed to be used, we can go down that path too. How do you interpret his comments there?
Well, first of all, he spoke like someone who knows his profession. He spoke like someone who understands national defense strategy, as someone who understands the nature of nuclear weapons. Launch reliability is a huge issue. I mean, how many TOW missiles did we fire in 1991 that simply blew up after they left the tube or grounded out? A surprising number. And in most cases, these were not really old TOW missiles.
Yeah,
they simply did not work properly. And what he's talking about is an understanding that there is something to be said for testing. Now, he talked about the fuel in the missiles. A couple of years ago, the Chinese made inspections of their missile batteries that are on the coast, and they discovered that, surprise, surprise, there was no fuel in the rockets. It had been removed and sold on the black market. Well, that's China that has an enormous problem with corruption. But my point is, there is a rationale for testing, as he points out. And it may be useful, as he suggested, in the context of deterrence, because people will discover that perhaps it doesn't all work as advertised, or they will discover that it's intact. In any case, a mix will emerge, and that will have an impact on future arms limitation talks. This man is not talking about going to war with anyone. He's made that very clear. He's explaining what goes on in the minds of people that have to deal with nuclear weapons at the highest levels. It's very refreshing. I cannot imagine any scenario in which anybody I dealt with in the White House or on the Hill could stand up and be as eloquent, articulate, and directly accurate as President Putin is. That's frightening, but I think that's where we are.
Well, there's another one that probably would not fit in that category, who, after Putin had made those comments, didn't seem to get the deterrent message. And in fact, they seem to be going down the path of thinking that this is just bluff on Putin. And that is Foreign Policy Chief Kaya Kallas.
Ukraine's defense is European defense. So that's why we are also working on next packages to help you with the military needs. When it comes to also politically supporting you, then we are working on the 19th package of sanctions to put more pressure on Russia to really end this war. Russia's economy is already weak. We are making it weaker by our sanctions.
So no thought whatsoever to slowing down or backing down on anything. The only thing the European Union, NATO, Western Europe, Ukraine, and apparently the White House are thinking is more war support, not even looking at the possibility of that. How do you interpret that?
I think she's reading from the talking points that were sent to her by von der Leyen. And if you listen to either of these women, you know, if you can stomach it for any length of time, you walk away and throw up your hands in disgust. These people don't know what they're talking about. They don't know what they're doing. They are just repeating utterly false talking points. These are narratives crafted in London and in McLean by the CIA and MI6. That's what it is. That's all there is to it. If you're looking for someone who should be held responsible for this sort of thing, I think Ratcliffe and the CIA is a good candidate. And he appears to be the ultimate instrument of these narratives as well. It's dangerous, but I don't see any evidence that President Trump has the foundation of experience, knowledge, and understanding to challenge it. And so he repeats it. But he needs to re-examine the wisdom of doing so, because he could find himself in the most unenviable position of any president in the history of this country, of precipitating a war with a country that is not our enemy, that does not want war, and a war that could rapidly spread to a global level and bring in at least half the world, plus China, maybe even India, on the side of Russia against us. I don't see how the world benefits from it. I don't see how we benefit from it. So we have to abandon these outrageous demands and extreme goals. I mean, if you listen carefully to everyone, the only solution to this crisis in Ukraine is for the Russians to wake up tomorrow morning, disarm, beg forgiveness, and all run in formation back to Russia. That's not going to happen. And that is the expectation, all based on this utter nonsense that Russia is weak, Russia is backward, Russia's suffering, Russia's this, Russia's that. Talk to the people that have recently been in Russia. They'll come back and tell you that's complete and utter nonsense.
And if anyone has been paying attention on the front line, the problem is, I think that the Kaya Kallases, the Ursula von der Leyens, the Keir Starmers, they think that time is unlimited, that they can just keep rolling this year after year and just keep the war going on, keep harming Russia as they imagine things. But there's a problem with that, and that is it matters what happens on the front line. And right now, there's a couple of key areas on the Eastern Front that are on the verge of collapsing, and that is in the Pokrovsk area, and that is in the Kupiansk area. Russia had been going this slow grind for a while, but they now have about half of each of those cities are in danger of taking all of both of them in the near term. At the same time, and this is a big issue, news out of the Ukrainian media just this morning is talking about that the law enforcement officials have revealed open source that almost 290,000 cases of CZCH, that's basically AWOL in U.S. parlance, were desertions from the full-scale war. And according to the article, in response to Ukraine's inquiry, the prosecutor general reported that from January 2022 to September 25, 235,000 criminal proceedings were registered under this AWOL situation, 53,000 for desertions. And as of comparisons from 2022 to September 24, so a year ago, law enforcement had only had about 60,000. So that shows you that, almost 100, over 150,000 in just the last year alone, and these things continue on. When I did some further reading on some of the from the Ukrainska Pravda, they explain some of the reasons why. And they say that the motivation is just going through the tank because it says many of the surviving members of the Ukraine professional military that have been serving, some of which since 2022, never have gotten a release. They have never gotten to go home, and so they said mentally they're just out. So they said the only thing they have is to desert. And they're just tired of fighting and dying on a war that they realize they can't win. At some point, Doug, I would imagine this is going to reach some kind of critical mass. When you add in there the huge losses on top of all this, I just don't know how you keep sustaining this forever.
Well, as long as you can rely on the United States to provide you with a support package that includes mission planning and execution personnel, and they will launch Tomahawk missiles for you to maintain the fiction that you, as a viable state, are still alive and that you have some warfighting capacity, I guess it can go on. That's the problem. In other words, everything is a facade. You know, we were talking earlier about President Trump's passion for optics. Well, optics seem to determine a great deal in Western Europe. And all of this is because the pain and suffering that you're describing doesn't strike Europe or the United States. No one is feeling any pain. So when somebody says, well, let's give them Tomahawks, that'll teach them a lesson. And you think that you're the greatest power on earth and that you're fighting a substandard force, a backward military establishment, I guess that's okay. In other words, what you're talking about is reality. But how much reality creeps into the discussion in the West? You just had Kallas on. We've listened to von der Leyen. We've listened to the defense minister in Germany. These people have lost their minds. They're completely out of touch with reality. They have no idea what they're talking about. They don't understand the destructive capacity of modern weapons. They don't understand that this war that they've been watching at a distance could suddenly close that distance very rapidly with them. And I don't know why this doesn't sink in, except that there's no background. There's no experience. That's the only thing I can think of, because if you talk to anybody, American, British, or German, or Soviet, or Russian, who's fought in the Second World War, they'd be horrified at these kinds of remarks because they lived it. They saw it. But that's not what we're dealing with. We're dealing with the sort of freshman class of the new age, where war is a push-button exercise. And there are very few casualties. And if there are casualties, they occur on somebody else's soil.